realize that I have a habit of changing titles from the time they are published to the time that I preach them, and sometimes I change them after I preach them. I've decided to, in honor of a radio program that used to be on, some of you, of course, wouldn't be that old, but there was a radio program that I think was called Life Begins at 40. So I have decided, in honor of that, to entitle this chapter, Life Begins at 130. And that is really true. There is a story, I fear I may have told it to you before, that sort of depicts the mood that I see in chapter 46. And it's supposed to be true. An elderly couple, they were 100 years old, had decided to get a divorce. And so they went to the judge, and the case was aired, and the judge granted the divorce. But his curiosity was just too much for him, and so the judge said to the couple after the divorce was granted, "I just have to ask you this. Why would you wait so long?" And the man, former husband, turned to the judge and said, "We were waiting for our children to die." I have heard some incredible stories in my life. That, according to Mark Twain, is probably true. It is hard to believe. I see Jacob as a man who's waiting to die, too. He's been dying for years. Back in chapter 37, he talked about going down to Sheol with his gray hair. Chapter 42, he says, "I will go to Sheol mourning." Chapter 45, he says, now knowing that Joseph is alive, "I will go to my son before I die." And then he sees his son in chapter 46, and he says, "Now I can die." And God says to him, "Not yet, Jacob. You got 17 years left." And as a matter of fact, they were the best 17 years of his life. Life for Jacob really did begin, I think, at 130. The clue, I think, comes to us from chapter 47, verse 9. There he stands before Pharaoh, and he says, "The years of my sojourning are 130, few and unpleasant." Well, I guess they were few and unpleasant. His one, Abraham had lived to be 175, Isaac 180. He was only 130 and going strong. "Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning." I'd like to suggest that Jacob was looking forward to death because his life really had not been that significant, and it surely had not been that enjoyable. See, I look at the situation as it occurs in the life of Jacob, and I see that his sons have come after years, have come to the point of repentance in chapter 44. They saw all of the evil that came into their life, all of the hard times as a result of their sin, and it was God's chastening in their life. And so they said, "This is because of what we have done to our brother," not knowing that the one before whom they stood was their brother. And it was after that point of repentance where they turned and they decided not to sacrifice Benjamin for self-interest, that they evidenced a change of heart and mind and life, which we call repentance. Forgiveness was granted in chapter 45. Do you know, I see that Jacob has not yet been turned about. Not yet. And it is only until chapter 46 and 47 that I see the turning point in Jacob's life, where he turns from misery and sorrow and pain and suffering and self-centeredness to the joy-filled life that should have been years before. And that's what I'd like to focus on. The last chapter of the life of Jacob was the best. And I want to analyze that conversion, if you would. I believe he was a saved man before this. I believe he trusted in God. But there was a turning point in his life that I think is significant for him and certainly for us as well. So I want to focus on the characteristics of that turning in Jacob's life so that these final 17 years can be the finest he has ever lived. Now, the first seven verses are a description, as you can see, of the agonizing decision that is made, that Jacob made, to go down into Egypt. Kind of interesting, because as I read it, Jacob made what may have seemed to be a hasty decision. He had lived there. The famine was going on intensely. He did not know, but there were five more years of it left. The famine was intense in the land of Canaan. The family was in danger of starvation. And all of a sudden, he hears from his sons that the son he had assumed to be dead for more than 20 years was really alive, and that he was second in command in Egypt, and that he had called for his father and all of his family to come down. I think Jacob packed his bags without thinking a lot about it. And it wasn't until he got to Beersheba that suddenly the impact of what he was doing dawned upon him, and he stopped for a moment and began to reflect and to make a more deliberate decision. Few of us can really appreciate the intensity of the decision to move. My wife and I moved from Washington State to Dallas now almost 14 years ago. That for us was traumatic. But can you imagine a man 130 years old making that move, leaving everything behind that spelled comfort and security? 130 years old. He was an old man, and old people, I don't like to move. But people, as they grow older, become more attached to their surroundings. And here was a man at 130, twice retirement age. And he's picking up, and he's going into another land. He doesn't know the language. He doesn't know the culture. And they don't like Hebrews. How would you feel about that move? What would that do to your sense of security? Well, I think it did it to Jacob too. His thinking began to be gelled when he arrived at Beersheba. Beersheba was an interesting place. It is the place where Abraham made a covenant with Abimelech, and he called upon the name of the Lord. It was the place where Abraham and Isaac returned to and dwelled after Abraham sacrificed Isaac on Mount Moriah. It was the place where Jacob lived when he conned his brother out of his birthright and he stole the blessing from his father. It was the place that Jacob left, fleeing for his life from his brother whom he had cheated and going into Haran. And by the way, as he thought about that, he must have remembered, the last time I was leaving Beersheba, I was going northeast to Haran to go to Laban's, and Mama said it was going to be for a few days. And it was over 20 years. No wonder Jacob was thinking about what he was doing. Beersheba was a very significant point of departure. Then Beersheba was also the southernmost point in the land of Canaan. You remember that in the Old Testament, one of the descriptions of the land of Israel was from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south. That was the northern and southern extremity of the land. Beersheba was on the tail end of Palestine. And Jacob knew that. It's like going out of state, and when you get to the last town in Texas, it says, such and such, the last point in Texas, so the next place is going to be New Mexico. It was the end of the line, so far as Canaan was concerned. That was the land, it was the end of the line in terms of the land that God had promised Abraham in Genesis 12 and Genesis 15 to give him. It was the land that God had promised Isaac in chapter 26. It was the land that God had twice promised Jacob. This land I am going to give to you and to your descendants. And what's he doing? He's leaving. How would you feel about that? He is now at the point of no return, leaving Beersheba, going south to Egypt. He is out of Canaan, the very land God had promised to give and the place he had promised to bless. If that is not enough, he was going from Canaan to Egypt. Now, Jacob had a sense of history about him. And if you have a sense of history, you will remember that there was a famine that came in Genesis chapter 12 in the land of Canaan. And Abraham responded to that famine by going to Egypt. And there he lied about his wife, and she ended up in Pharaoh's harem. And God divinely protected her purity. He also gave Abraham an escort back to Canaan. That was a mistake. In Genesis chapter 26 and verse 2, there is another famine that comes in the land, and this time it is Isaac who is giving thought, and God says to Isaac, don't go down to Egypt. You go to the land that I show you. Now, how would you feel if you were Jacob? And you already had this caravan of U-Haul trailers working their way down at Beersheba, ready to leave Canaan, the land of promise, to enter into Egypt, which had been forbidden territory. How would you feel? That's right. Mighty cautious. Well, that's what I see as the backdrop to what takes place in verse 1. So he's at Beersheba and he offers sacrifices. That expression is used only of Jacob thus far. It is used very frequently in the sacrificial system that comes in the law. It is used only of Jacob, who makes a sacrifice, who makes a covenant with Laban, a non-aggression treaty. And they did it by the cutting of an animal. That is the only time that I know of that Jacob offered a blood sacrifice that is recorded. Abraham did. Isaac did. Well, you may be thinking back about Bethel, and you say, but remember when Jacob was at Bethel the first time? Remember when he was at Bethel the second time? Yes, I do. What did he do there? He didn't slay an animal. He got out his oil and poured it on the rock. It was consecrated, but there was no sacrifice. This is the first time that there is a worshipful activity, so far as I can see, on the part of Jacob. And I think the intent, while it is a general expression, it does not designate a particular kind of approach to God as the very technical worship procedures of the law laid out. It was not a particular kind so far as the designation of it is concerned. But I can tell you what I think he was doing. He was asking God for guidance. God had spoken to Isaac there at Beersheba and confirmed his covenant with him. And I can assure you, and by the way, God's answer is in response to the question which had to be asked. Lord, are you sure about this? Are you sure I'm going the right way to Egypt? It was kind of like Gideon's fleece. So God responds to him, and this provides the basis now for his activities as he goes on down into Egypt. God said to him, I am God, the God of your father. That meant the God who had made the promises to Isaac, the promises of the covenant, the promises of the land of Canaan, the promises of a mighty nation. And Isaac had been told that the God who spoke to him was the God of his father, the God of Abraham. So it is the Abrahamic covenant and all of those promises that are tied in with God as he reveals himself. And if we didn't think that Jacob was afraid, God said he was. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. I would have been scared to death. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. Why? For I will make you a great nation there. Isn't that an amazing thing? All of the promises that God had made, God had said he would make them a great and mighty nation, but everybody assumed that God was going to do it in Canaan. And God says, wrong. The reason why you can relax about going to Egypt is because I'm going to make you great in Egypt, not in Canaan. And when you come back to Canaan, you are going to be a great nation to possess it. So the assurance is that God has intended them to be there, and the blessing of God is coming upon them in Egypt. Had he not gone to Egypt, humanly speaking, no blessing. That was the place of blessing. And that's a strange thing, because usually we're inclined to think that Egypt was the forbidden place. It certainly was for Abraham, and it was for Isaac. Some people have said that Egypt was symbolic of evil, and therefore we ought to stay out of Egypt. Well, it sure wasn't true for Jacob. And the reason is that the place is not predominantly important. It's the person and his relationship with God. The reason he could go to Egypt is because God said, I will make you a great nation there. I will go with you. Jacob didn't go alone. See, God had to tell Jacob the same thing when he went up to Haran. That was out of the land. That was to the northeast up in Mesopotamia. He'd gone out of Beersheba to do that. God had to speak to him at Bethel on the way up. And God said, don't be afraid. This place is a holy place. The ladder that ascended into heaven showed that God had a special purpose for that place, Israel. But as he left it, God said, I'm going with you. I'm going to bring you back. I will bring about all of my promises. And he did. But now he's going south, and he's not sure whether God goes south as well as north. So God says it again. I'm going to be with you. I will bless you. I will go down. And notice he says, and you will come up. Now I think the you, while it is singular, the you is obviously you in the sense of his descendants that are described in later verses. Well, he goes up, they carry up his body as he requests. But he goes up in his seed. And that is what God is assuring him, because then he goes on to say, and Joseph will close your eyes. It is there, I believe, that Jacob understands that he will finally get to die. God's going to let him die after all. 147 years old, 17 years later, he's going to die, and Joseph will be there to comfort him when he does. That was the word that Jacob needed to hear. You know, it just occurred to me as between the services, I was sitting there thinking about that. Most of us equate great visions like this with spirituality, don't we? I mean, isn't that tremendous? It must be a terrific experience to have these kind of encounters with God. But I want to warn you about something. Don't equate them with spirituality. Do you notice that in the Scriptures, Jacob has three of these, if I've counted right, at least three. Joseph never had one. Joseph didn't need God to give him some razzle-dazzle, sparkling experience. Joseph knew God was with him in the prison. So far as Scripture is concerned, God never said to Joseph, "Relax, Joseph, I'm here." Joseph knew it. We don't have to have those kinds of experiences. And the reason that Jacob had to, folks, was because he was not what we would call a spiritual man. Okay, so the assurance comes. And now he is on his way. U-Haul caravan starts up again, moving south. And now in verses 8 through 27, the reason we didn't read them is because we need the time. And I don't want to linger too long. I am not saying the genealogy is not important. Hopefully we have dealt with that before. There are several interesting characteristics of the genealogies. Not everybody is named. For instance, pardon us women, but you notice that Moses does not name the wives of the sons. Now Moses, he didn't know anything about the movement that goes on today amongst women. He was not a prejudiced man. He had a purpose in what he wrote. It says that there were 70 that went in all. There were really more than 70. For example, there were probably servants. They are not named. Surely they went along too. We see that when Shechem was sacked, they took the Shechemite women and children and they took them unto themselves. They married them. They took them and assimilated them into the tribe. We are not given that either. undoubtedly there were more than 70 who went down. And so don't take it personally just because he leaves out the names of the wives. Why does he tell us who went? Well, you will notice in later genealogies, as the nation is coming back out of Egypt and going in to possess the land, it was vitally important to know from whence you came, your roots, if you were to possess the land by tribe. And you will discover that the leaders that are mentioned in later genealogies as they're coming out of Egypt are all named here. Now, not everybody who is named here is a later leader. That is because some of them may have died, their clan may not have developed and materialized, but everybody that comes out comes from here. And that tells me, and it tells others, that what we see is a restrictive listing of the leadership of the tribe of Israel that is going to emerge during that time of captivity and that will appear once they come out again. It is absolutely essential that the historical link be maintained. But he is not trying to tell us everybody that went to Egypt. There is another purpose, and that purpose comes from Deuteronomy chapter 26. You know, it really wasn't a very big group, was it? 70 people. And yet, look at how many come out at the Exodus. There is this huge populace that comes forth because God said, I will make you a great nation there. What do you expect? 100,000 people to go down to Egypt if they're going to be a great nation when they come out? No wonder there's so few. And here is a historical example in Deuteronomy 26. Now this is presupposing they are back in the land, they are enjoying the blessings of God, and they are giving of the first fruits of the crops, the first products they give to God as a token of the fact that they acknowledge this is God's gift, this is God's blessing upon them. And what do they say? Start at verse 4. Then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God, and you shall answer and say before the Lord your God, my father, Jacob, Israel, my father was a wandering, notice the margin, New American Standard, perishing, starving, hungry, destitute. My father was a perishing Aramean, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. But there he became a great, mighty, and populous nation. You know what this passage reminds us of? That God was right. They were few in number. And they are numbered for us just to prove it. We don't have to read genealogies all the hour. This basically prescribes those who went. God made a mighty nation, not in Canaan, but in Egypt. Well, that's what I see to be the purpose of the genealogy, to teach us the matter of humility and to teach the nation the matter of humility, and that becoming great often happens in a different way and even in a different place than we may suspect. All right, let's look at the reunion now that takes place in verses 28 through 30. I tell you, we could linger there a long time. Think of the emotional buildup. Over 20 years, father and son have not met. And now all of a sudden they come together. Joseph, or Jacob, in the latter years of his life, Joseph, who had asked his brothers, even before his identity was known, how is that old man of yours? Not in a derogatory fashion now, but that old man up home. How is he, the one that you told me about? And the first thing Joseph said when he told his brothers he was Joseph was, how's my father? Well, there's the meeting that takes place described in verses 28 through 30. They come to Goshen. Notice that Judah was sent as the guide. He was sent down apparently again to Egypt. He knew the way, of course. He was sent to Egypt, and Joseph gave him directions for how to get to Goshen, because it wasn't real close. And he then leads the party into Goshen, and Joseph gets in his chariot and goes out to be reunited with his father. And he wept on his neck, and now here's old Jacob, ready to die again. That guy's been dying for years. Then Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen your face, and that you are still alive. And God keeps saying, not yet, Jacob, not yet. He's ready to pull the plug because he's tired of suffering. He's tired of the kind of life he's had, and rightly so. Now, I call the next section Getting Goshen, and that's verses 28 through chapter 6 of chapter 47. The problem that I agonized with as I studied this is, what's the big deal about Goshen? Why was so much effort spent in describing just getting to Goshen? You would have thought that was an incidental. Let me make some suggestions to you about it. Obviously, you have gathered that I make the chapter division somewhere other than the chapter dividers did. I make the division at verse 12. And at least on this, often I am out on the proverbial limb, there are those who agree with me. It leaves you hanging for Joseph to be saying to his brothers, "Now, fellas, you're going to go to Pharaoh." And Pharaoh's going to say, "What do you guys do for a living? And this is what I want you to tell." And then stop there. I like to get through the event where they do go before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, "Hey, you guys ought to live in Goshen." Now, interestingly enough, Joseph has already sent them to Goshen. I mean, they've unpacked their bags, sent the wagons back, and started pitching tents. It was no surprise. Joseph planned on them going to Goshen. He had told his brothers that. And Pharaoh had not really named Goshen, but he had said, "I'll give you the best of the land." He assured them of that. Why is it so important? Well, notice that Joseph says to them, you wouldn't think he'd have to do this, but you know what Joseph's really telling his brothers? When you stand before Pharaoh, tell him the truth. He's going to ask you what you do. Tell him you're shepherds. Now listen, that's easier for us to do because we're not standing before a guy who doesn't like shepherds. You know, what do you do? Well, there are some things that just aren't popular. And shepherds, as Joseph tells them, weren't popular in Egypt. Maybe they'd have said, "Well, we're a craftsman," or whatever. There was a real danger had they done that. So he simply says, tell them the truth. Tell them you're shepherds. You've done that all your lives. You don't know how to do anything else. And that's the instruction. And then he gives them the cultural clue in verse 34. For every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. I suspect then that there was a real opening in the labor market, so far as shepherds were concerned. Maybe the others were overcrowded. Not shepherds. All these openings. And by the way, you know, Pharaoh says, if any of you guys have any extra time, you could take after my flocks too. Little side job. So Joseph's brothers come before Pharaoh, five of them as representatives, and they stand before Pharaoh, presented by their brother. And so he says to them, "Well, what's your occupation?" And as Joseph had instructed them, and as the truth indeed was, they said, "We are shepherds, both we and our fathers." That is, not only is that all we've ever known, that's all our family's ever known. It's a family tradition. And so they said to Pharaoh then, "We have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen." So Pharaoh answered, surprisingly, of course, and says to them, "Well, fellas, and well, Joseph, your brothers are here now, and we're going to give them the best of the land, and let's put them in Goshen." Let's do. They're already there, and that's what they had asked for. And I really think that Joseph had prearranged this. I do not think that he is forcing Pharaoh's hand. I think that as an administrator, he had paved the way, he had laid out all things in order, and now Pharaoh has confirmed he had already committed himself to give them the best of the land, so if they happened to ask for the best of the land, he was committed to give it to them. Now, why? Why was it so important for them to be in Goshen? I mean, all those verses don't need to be there if it wasn't important. Well, there's one reason, and I suppose the old materialist in us sees that first. It was the best of the land. Now, where would you, supposing that God had brought you to Dallas, and he said, "Behold, here's all the city of Dallas. Where would you like to live?" Don't tell me you wouldn't have a real estate appraiser out there looking at the land. You would. You know where the big houses are. You know where the expensive part of town is. You know what property values are like. You're not going to go live in the low rent district. It was the best of the land. I suppose many of us would stop there. There was another reason. Joseph had given it in chapter 45 and verse 10. "And now you shall live in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me." See, it was important that they be in the land that would provide food for their cattle.
You would expect that. They had cattle and herds, and they had to provide for them. Goshen was the land that provided that. It looks to me like if the famine was hard-pressed everywhere in Egypt, it was the least hard-pressed in Goshen. They seemed to do rather well during the famine. Joseph's motivation was in part that in Goshen they could be close by, I think 20 or 25 miles away from the city of Ramses, where he could go and visit with them and they would be not too far from him. Because Joseph couldn't leave the palace, not during the second of the 7 years of famine. He had some administrating to do and he had some hard hours to put in. I think there's another reason, and I think it's the most important. Goshen was the safest place for his brothers to be because there the Egyptians wouldn't be. Egyptians hated shepherds. I think they hated sheep. I don't like them myself. Now, don't tell me that the highfalutin people, that the social life of Egypt revolved around Goshen. I don't believe it. The Egyptians stayed away from the place. It was close enough for Jacob to get to his brothers. But Egypt wasn't trying to get to his brothers. It was far enough. And I think Pharaoh was thinking, as he's clicking away all these things through his computer, he's not only saying, I want to give you the best of the land, he's saying, I think I'd like you guys about as far away from me as I can get you. And my people. His people didn't like them. Do you think he's going to move them into the city? Put them in suburbia? In North Egypt? No way. So he puts them out, and you see, that was what enabled the nation to be somewhat incubated. The real danger was in being accepted, not in being rejected. It was the Canaanites who had a, come on, folks, mentality, join us. Remember, the danger happened in Jacob's life when he went to live in Shechem, and he lived right next to it. Remember? He pitched his tent in city limits. And then Dinah decided she wanted to get to know the girls of the land. And she unfortunately got to know one of the fellows of the land. And then Jacob's sons killed him off. The great problem was not being rejected, it was being accepted. And so God put them out in a place, and Joseph, I believe, was very concerned about that. That they would not be too intimately related to the city life. That's why I said, tell them you're shepherds. If you're a craftsman, he'll move you into town. Now as shepherds, he'll keep you out of the way where you can remain as an integral family, tight-knit unit that had to be. That few of people could easily have been assimilated into Egyptian culture and life. Only Joseph was strong enough to stand it. He already had an Egyptian name and an Egyptian wife. What do you think would have happened to his brothers? I think that's the reason for it there. Now, the last part is what I call a patriarch blesses a pharaoh. It must have been a strange scene. Crippled up, I assume, old man he would have been after that ride on that ox cart, I'll tell you that. He stands before Pharaoh, and some strange things happen. He blesses Pharaoh. Now, isn't that an unusual thing? Some of the commentators say, well, it couldn't have been that way. It couldn't have been that way. It must be just a way of saying he greeted them. Howdy, Pharaoh. I don't think so. The word is the most common, frequently used word for the pronouncement of a blessing. It is used of Jacob blessing his sons in the next chapters. You know, it really was a blessing. Pharaoh was blessed by the presence of Jacob and his sons. He had been blessed already by the presence of Joseph. Joseph saved his kingdom. He saved his administration. The Egyptians say it. Not Joseph. It was a blessing to have Egypt there. By the way, you know it was a curse upon Canaan to have Israel move south. Remember what God said to Abraham, or said to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15? He said there are going to be 400 years that the people that were the offspring of Abraham were going to live in a land that wasn't theirs, but God was going to bring them out. You know what his last statement is? for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. There were two dangers. One, if Israel stayed in Canaan, they would get rotten like Canaan. The other danger was if they stayed in Canaan, that Canaan wouldn't get as rotten as they were going to get before God judged them. God pulled Israel out of Canaan so that the rottenness and the corruption could grow to the point where God would judge it, the nation, when he sent his people back. It was a blessing to Egypt. It was a curse, I think, to Canaan. Now, the amazing part of all of this is what Jacob says to Pharaoh. All of us are familiar with various approaches to witnessing. How would you have witnessed to Pharaoh? What would you have said to him? Well, I can see Jacob reaching inside of his tunic or whatever and saying, "Hey, Pharaoh, have you ever heard of the four spiritual laws? Well, I'm going to tell you, law number one is God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life." Now, don't misunderstand me. But I'm saying, what would you do? What kind of a picture would you paint of Christianity, of faith in God? Would you paint a positive one or a negative one? I would suspect that all of us, we can't believe what Jacob is saying here. Jacob ought to be smiling and saying, "Oh, Pharaoh, it's been a wonderful life. It's been so beautiful being a Christian all these years." He doesn't say it. And, of course, the implication is, Pharaoh, if you want to have a good life like me, then you'll trust in God like me. He doesn't say that. He says in verse 9, "The years of my sojourning are 130. Sniffle, sniffle. You can just see the tears running down his eyes. "Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning." It's been a tough old grind, Pharaoh. That's his testimony. You know, I wondered about that, and I thought, boy, poor Pharaoh. You know what the beauty of this thing is? That Pharaoh had also been exposed to several years, 9, if I'm not mistaken, of Joseph. He knew what Joseph had been through, and he knew that Joseph had a vital, living faith in God. And I hope and pray that Pharaoh believed Joseph's testimony. I really hope he believed Jacob's, too. Because if Jacob was saying anything to Pharaoh, he was saying to him, "I've been where you have to a certain degree. I've been in positions of power. I've been out there scrapping, trying to keep my administration going. And frankly, my life is a mess." I think it was a warning, if anything. It was a warning to Pharaoh not to pursue the same course he had. And in that sense, Pharaoh has two alternatives in front of him: the bad illustration of Jacob and the good illustration of Joseph, both of whom had a faith in the living God. There are two ways to go. I've said that all along. First class and tourist. Get there whichever way you want. God will get you there. But I'm telling you, it's never fun to get to Nineveh in the belly of a whale. Never. So, here he is, standing before him. I think this is the key. I think this is the turning point. I think that finally Jacob has come to the last chapter of his life, and he looks back and he says to himself, as he says to Pharaoh, "I have lived a rotten life. Things have not been wonderful. They have not been glorious. They have not been beautiful. Not because God hasn't been there. He has. I didn't realize it. My theology was all these things are against me," as he says to his son. No, they weren't. The problem was, he was against God. He had started his religion in the wrong way. Remember back in 28? Everybody thinks that's a wonderful experience. He turned to God. In a sense, he did. But how did he relate to God? He says to God, "I'll tell you what," he related to him just like Laban. "Tell you what, God, you get me down or up to Haran, you get me back safe, and you bless the socks off me, I'll give you 10% of the action." That's what he said. Do you notice God never went back to Jacob and said, "Jacob, ante up. Where's that 10%? He never collected. Jacob had a misconception of what God wanted. He thought God wanted an eager beaver who would go out, shave the ethical system, fleece the flock, including Laban, and then give God a piece of the action. All of his life was lived on that principle. And listen, Jacob's life was lousy. His birth was a struggle. He wrestled with his brother in the womb. He rips his brother off. He alienates his father. He never sees his mother again. He goes off to get one wife and gets four and a father-in-law like Laban. They have to make a treaty not to attack each other as he leaves. He goes to Shechem. His daughter is raped. He loses his prized wife in the prime of her life on the way to Bethel. He loses his favorite son, and his next favorite son is in jeopardy. Would you call that a good life? And all of it was the product of Jacob's self-effort. This is the turning point for Jacob. He finally comes to that point in his life, and he says, man, what a mess! God's been there all the time, but I didn't know it. I was going my own way. Everything I ever worked for has fallen apart in my hands, and every blessing I ever received was in spite of what I have done. Here he was trying to rip off his brother for the birthright so he can have all the land that belongs to his father, and he leaves it. What did he have in his hands that was the product of his scheming and devices? Nothing. Everything he had was the product of his activity, his preferential treatment of one wife over another. His preferential treatment of one son over another, what did it result in? In Joseph being taken away, and Benjamin almost. That's what had come across Jacob. He finally saw the light and said, hey, it isn't supposed to be this way. And that, I think, was the turning point. You know what's something interesting about Jacob that fascinates me? More space is devoted to Jacob than any patriarch. Do you notice that in the book of Genesis, thousands of years are spanned from chapter 1 to chapter 50. And do you notice that half of those chapters, chapter 25 through 49, you could almost count 50, are dealing with the life and times of Jacob. More time than Joseph gets, more time than Abraham gets, chapter 12 to chapter 25. Why? Well, I'd like to suggest that it took 130 years to get Jacob to the point of understanding what sanctification is all about. That's why he lived so long. He thought it was short. It took him 130 years to comprehend that a relationship with God is recognizing your absolute inability to do anything for God. Now, at the point of going down to Egypt, he was helpless, he was hopeless, he didn't have money, he didn't have influence, they hated him, so far as his race was concerned. He had no clout, and now all he could do was go on the basis that God had said to go, and on the basis that God would provide and would bring him back a great nation. He had nothing to offer God. And finally, God knocks all the props out from under, and he has to say to Pharaoh, I made a huge mess. But you know what? Not one word is said of Jacob and his spiritual life until after this. Not one. You go and you look at the Hall of Faith in Hebrews chapter 11. You know where it is? I already told you where it was, and you ought to know. He's leaning on his cane. Hardly can stand up, and then he worships God. He's got one foot in the grave, the other on a banana peel, and finally, he worships God. And the turning point came when God brought him to the point where there was nothing left for him to offer God. And now he had to rely and rest in the grace of God and the fact that God's word was true, and he didn't need a cheater to help him do it. You know, it's a real lesson, isn't it, in the grace of God. God had promised that fella years before that he was going to bless him. And all those years, Jacob tried to help God out. And they were all basically a loss. Until now, the turning point. Interesting, isn't it, that the last chapter of Jacob's life was his finest. After the age of 130, life had finally begun. 17 years, I think, of real enjoyment, of worship, of fellowship. Because now Jacob understood that the ultimate good in life was knowing God. It wasn't being in Canaan. It wasn't having the biggest bank account in Canaan. It was knowing God and being intimate with Him and knowing that wherever He was, in Egypt or Canaan, in the palace or the pit, it didn't matter, so long as God was there. And that God could bless him wherever he was, so long as he was rightly related to Him and trusting in Him. The last chapter of Jacob's life was the finest. I don't really know what chapter your life is in. It doesn't have to turn at the last. It just took Jacob that long to figure it out, and God that long to kick out all the props. All of us face life. There's a book that's called Passages. I haven't read it. Some of you probably have. All of us have passages in our life, points at which there are critical turns, the loss of a job, the loss of a loved one, a move physically. The exciting thing for the Christian is that no matter how threatening, no matter how insecure, no matter how unsettling those passages are, God is there. And God's promise is, I will never leave you or forsake you. God's promise is that if you are one of His by faith in the shed blood of Jesus Christ, He is going to bring you to the point of being intimate with Him. And He does that in many ways. Passages. I don't know what chapter your life is in, but I know this, that where real happiness comes is the chapter at which God finally shows us that it is not what we can do for God, it is what God will do for us that brings real blessing.